Start out and tell us about your organization, the Oakland Institute.
The Oakland Institute is an independent policy think tank. Our intent and goal is to increase public participation, fair debate on social, economic policy issues that impact our lives.
One of your interests is the impacts on the world hunger and food crisis situation.
Mm-hmm.
You just recently produced a report on that. Can you talk about that?
Definitely. Well, we are actually living in very unfortunate times, given the kind of resources we have. We have over a billion people, that is nearly a sixth of humanity, living in chronic hunger, predominantly in the developing world. And at the same time, the solutions that are put forward to deal with this hunger tend to be the same old solutions, more trade liberalization. We need to have more technological solutions to hunger. But we are forgetting the structural causes of hunger. What really causes hunger? People are poor and hungry, even in the United States, not because U.S. cannot produce enough food. It's about having access and control over resources. It's about living wage jobs. So a trend that we are seeing in the third world right now is, which is a new mantra of development that has been given to third world countries, is, well, sell what you have, and what you have is land. So rich nations such as Japan, which are heavily dependent on food imports, are now going into poor countries, buying up land, where small farmers used to grow food for their families and communities, and using that land to grow food for, you know, imports to their own country so they can bring their import bill down, or to grow biofuels to run their, you know, their cars and the rest. So this phenomena, you're seeing China, Saudi Arabia, Japan, India also, going into poorer nations, buying up land, the only resource that is left for them, it is basically the new blood diamond, and leaving communities with nothing. And in some ways, it's not a new trend, because if you look at your Chiquita plantations in Latin America or in the Philippines, we know what that does. It takes away the land reform from the agenda, the absolute need for it if you want to deal with hunger and poverty in those nations. And it creates new colonial structures where your resources are controlled by outside powers just because they have the money. Unfortunately, this trend is being called a win-win situation by the international financial institutions such as the World Bank and its international finance corporations, who are really greasing the process, making it possible. So we tend to focus on China and Saudi Arabia, who are going and buying this land. But the ones who are making it possible are the private investors and the international finance corporation of the World Bank. And it's a very dangerous trend. There cannot be any win-win out of it. The developing countries who are selling their land will only see further starvation and hunger in their midst. And that's what the report does, exposes the role of the international financial institutions in this land grab or selling of land.
What is the U.S. role in this land grab?
Well, in terms of the United States, I mean, if you look at the World Bank, it is called the World Bank, but we know it is controlled by the United States. So it is this whole development methodology that is being promoted, and USAID and others would say, okay, we come up with a code of conduct, so make sure that it's not a complete lose situation for developing countries. But as our report shows, there cannot be any win-win situation. We need to create policy space for developing countries to be able to put in place structures that will ensure policies that promote self-sufficiency in food, policies that would ensure land reform for the people. Unfortunately, so-called donor countries, they're not giving much, such as the United States, are an obstacle, and they ensure that policy space is taken away from developing countries, and instead we have technological solutions such as the new green revolution being shoved down the throats of developing countries.
So when you talk about the U.S., is it the U.S. government or is it U.S. corporations or both?
You know, sometimes it's really hard to differentiate. And yes, we do know that we'll have real changes. The corporations have far more access to the U.S. government than the ordinary citizens of the world and citizens of this country itself. So yes, the trends of development that we are seeing do benefit U.S. corporations.
Can you name any specific U.S. corporations involved in this?
In terms of land grab, you know, one of the interesting things is it's not just the rich countries. You also have private investment firms. So you would find, you know, Wall Street companies who have seen a big decline in the last couple of years with the financial crisis. They're looking for new venues for putting their money down for investment. And what they have found, land is the big place to put money in. So they are buying up land in third world countries as well and facilitating those deals. And our report goes into the details of many of those companies that are involved in it.
Can you give us a couple of examples? And I believe you also mentioned earlier Africa, is Africa being, land there being bought up significantly?
Well, you know, some of the interesting examples, well, Madagascar comes to mind, where nearly more than half of the arable land was going up for sale last year. And it was the South Korean company that was involved in it, actually, in that case. Once the news got out, it was really resistance from the farmers' movement and the civil society and shining the light on the Dracula that drove this Dracula away. But that's the kind of the extent of it that we're talking about, that nearly half of the country's arable land can be sold without questioning where will the food for the people of Madagascar grow? Where will the food come from? And it's also very interesting, given what happened last year, where we saw the food prices increase. There was a nearly 83% increase in food prices between 2005-2008. And the poor in developing countries, who spend nearly 80% of their incomes on food, that is basically a recipe for famine. So when you're even giving away your land, you have even less land for growing food for yourself. And you have the poor who are already starving. It is, you know, it's no rocket science. It makes sense why nearly a sixth of humanity is today dealing with hunger. At the same time, we continue having international conferences. We had the G20 summit. We had the G8 summit. We now, right now as we speak, you know, there is, FAO is organizing a summit on how to feed the world by 2050. In November, you have the World Food Summit. It's no rocket science. We know how to feed the world. You know, we don't have to come up with some new technology thanks to the Gates Foundation or whatever. We know how to do it. What we have to figure out is how to remove those in power who prevent the solutions from being implemented.
Talk a bit more about the Gates Foundation and their investments in this green revolution.
Well, you know, the Gates Foundation, and especially the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, which has attracted much attention because, you know, it's an 800-pound gorilla which is striking up memorandums of understanding with the Food and Agriculture Organization, to IFAD, to whoever, to the European parliamentarians. It all, on paper, looks really good. It's all about feeding the poor. They have the rhetoric right that, you know, if you want to deal with hunger, you want to look at the small-scale farmers. 75% of the world's hungry are actually, ironically, I should say, the world's small-scale farmers. But the problem with that approach is, if you start looking at the agricultural development strategy, which is no longer confidential, but it was leaked to us last year when it was confidential, the executive summary goes on to talk about their vision. And their vision is to create this farmers who are successful in the market, and it goes on to talk about land mobility. Now, what is that land mobility? It's a euphemism for displacing people from land. We called up the Gates Foundation to see if they were hiring, because the executive summary and that 128-page long report does not talk about what to do with the small-scale farmers who might not be successful in the market and are moved off the land. So this new green revolution, which is based on heavy use of inputs and the rest, which means money. We're talking about not a small-scale farmer who has an acre or less in a place like India or some country in Africa. You're talking about middle-level farmers, middle-income farmers, you think the U.S. farmers. That's not the world's hungry. So you're talking about moving people off agriculture without an idea of where these people are going to go. We already know people are sinking in boats as they try to find their way into Europe. We know that people are dying on the borders of the United States as they try to cross the borders to come and find, you know, just a job. They find slavery in the fields of Florida and Texas, or death on the border, or xenophobic public and the legislators. So given all that, the Gates Foundation has the audacity to talk about curing hunger, feeding the world, and promoting a technological solution of hunger, and taking all the space which we need to talk about what causes hunger. We know that we have enough food today to provide more than 2,500 kilocalories per person per day around the world. It would make every Indian, which is home to the world's largest hungry population, chubby. So it's not that we don't have enough food to feed the world, but till we have people's access and control over natural resources, till people have land, till farmers have control over seed, water, as long as we do not have a corporate-owned food system, as long as we don't have living wage jobs, we will have hunger. And Gates Foundation misses that. Lastly, I would say, if they actually got down to the ground and actually talked to the people on the ground, they would know what would work. So it's a real waste of billions of dollars, if I might say that. But perhaps it's not for the corporations whose people are in very important positions within the Gates Foundation. A lot of their senior staff comes from Monsanto, for instance.
Gates Foundation also likes to push, as you pointed out, technological solutions, biotech, that's all they're trying to do mm-hmm. is come up with a better seed, and that will be the solution. What's the problem with that?
You know, the problem with that is, first of all, we've been hearing this rhetoric for more than a decade. You know, we have heard about the vitamin A rice, we have heard about nutrient-rich crops that will deal with malnutrition in the third world. Now, the problem is a child, for instance, that has vitamin A deficiency also has other deficiencies. And that's because they're not getting an adequate meal. So if a family cannot afford to put two decent meals before their children every day, how do you think they're going to buy this vitamin A rice? Secondly, so far we don't have a product that works. Right now, only four crops are grown commercially around the world that are genetically engineered. That is cotton, corn, canola, and soy. So, you know, when you talk about your nutrient-rich cassava and drought-resistant this, none of those products have worked so far. In fact, they've acknowledged that it's a failure. Lastly, in terms of, it's very interesting in the debate, actually, that they completely ignore some of the stuff that we do know. For instance, last year at the height of the food crisis, when everyone was talking about how to feed the world and what technology will help solve the problem, ISTAT, the International Assessment of Agricultural Science, Technology and Development, that was a multi-stakeholder process, happened over 4 years with some 400 scientists from around the world, they released their report. And it clearly said that genetic engineering is not the solution to feed the world. The way we are doing business, we have to change it. They talked about focusing on small-scale farmers. They talked about sustainable agriculture. And it was a process funded by the World Bank and others, but nobody talks about ISTAT when they come together at these conferences because they did not say what they were hoping it would say, or genetic engineering is the solution. We don't hear about it. We don't hear about the UNDP report that came out. They looked at 114 projects in Africa, and they said organic agriculture is the best way to do agriculture in Africa, given the environmental and other realities on the ground. Nobody talks about that report. And we keep having the same push that the way to feed the world is through genetic engineering, the way to improve livelihoods of farmers is GM crops. And they completely ignore farmer suicides in India, where farmers who went on to BT cotton are taking their own lives. It forgets that the farmers in China, which a study from Cornell University shows, the first farmers to adopt BT cotton, that after 7 years, the profits began to decline. Or they completely ignore the experience of farmers in South Africa who have played around with BT cotton to see disastrous results. We ignore the report from the Union of Concerned Scientists that just came out earlier this year, which shows that all these promises of increasing yield haven't happened in the United States. There was only a slight increase with BT corn, but that increase is less if you compare it to, say, if you were using conventional corn. So there is no evidence that genetically engineered crops will increase production, that they will improve the livelihoods of farmers. So they have to provide us the evidence rather than just these sound bites. And they haven't done that. Not to mention concerns around the impact on health, that the fact that there is no testing, it's all voluntarily done by the same companies who are putting these products in the market, the FDA, EPA, everyone is fast asleep on the wheel. This is really about democracy. And the question for the Gates Foundation is, do they believe in democracy? Do they believe in nations being sovereign, being able to decide what kind of foods are grown, how they're grown, and who gets to eat it?
The Seattle Times just yesterday had an article, I don't know if you had a chance to see mm-hmm. that, and I think the Gates Foundation response to a lot of the criticisms, well, we need a balance between, you know, the critics and what we're proposing. What's your response to that?
Well, our response is that the problem with the Gates Foundation is, as I said, it's an 800-pound gorilla which has moved in with all its resources, and they're putting all eggs in one basket. You know, Mr. Gates, I'm sure, is a very fine investor. And any investor would tell you that you never put all eggs in one basket, and that's what they have done. Their whole agricultural development strategy, their focus with Agra, it's all about promoting a technological revolution, completely ignoring the past experience of green revolution in places such as India. I mean, all he has to do is start listening to NPR, where there are stories of cancer trains in India. You know, Punjab and Haryana, which used to be the granaries of India, are today full of villages which are full of people suffering from cancer, heavy use of pesticides and the rest. I mean, this is not just some leftist crazy talk. I'm talking about the National Public Radio, or they're going to say it's not balanced anymore. So we have to weigh in the evidence. We have to weigh in the scientific evidence. And if we really have the political will to make a better sustainable world where needs of all people are met, we have to adopt the precautionary principle that till something is proven safe, we do not move ahead with it. And in case of the Green Revolution, we knew that it has destroyed the topsoil, it has poisoned our groundwater, it has poisoned the bodies of the farmers and their children. Why would we promote this idea elsewhere? Thank God Africa missed out on the first Green Revolution. Why would we continue promoting it? It's totally upside down and backwards. I do not understand the thinking. And I'm sure there are very fine minds behind it all.
Talk a bit about how the U.S. commodities markets has impacted the availability and prices of food.
Well, last year when I mentioned the food prices increases, there are several factors. I mean, and two factors which made it kind of unique, but they were short-term factors. One is, of course, the biofuels, the use of food grains such as corn, and policies of countries like the U.S. and the EU to use the grains for biofuel caused a lot of food shortages, especially for nations who have come to depend on imports, developing countries, because they're growing cash crops and coffee, not food for their own people. The other one was the commodity speculation. Again, investors who were looking for new venues to invest. They had seen the decline in the housing market. They were looking for a new place. They started pouring in, hedge funds and others started pouring in money into the commodities market, which is very new. You know, it used to be in the past a way for a farmer to know what the prices would be, how much to grow and all of that. But when people from the non-agriculture sector moved in and started putting in money, it basically led to real volatility in prices. So if you take the case of wheat last year, you know, the prices would go up in January, by March they're down, then they go up again. It was not linked at all with sudden increases in demand and supply. It was totally commodity speculation. But the impact of that was disastrous when you found people, as I said before, who spend 80% of their income on food, suddenly seeing that they could not afford wheat, rice, lentils, basic grains that ensure their survival, while somebody at the Wall Street was reaping in tons of money. So it has played a big role. I do, however, want to emphasize that while we need to focus on commodity speculation, we need to review the biofuel policies and ensure that we come up with policy changes that do not result in hunger, we have to deal with the most important issue, which is really how come nations that used to be once independent, were self-sufficient in food, are today becoming dependent on food imports, especially from places such as the US and EU. Developing countries used to have a food trade surplus of $7 billion in the 60s and 70s. By 2001, their food trade deficit was $11 billion. It's not that the people forgot how to grow their own food. It's really about the free trade policies. It is about unfair trading systems. It's about subsidies in the West, which can dump grains in third world countries. And no respect and recognition of the small farmer, that their livelihoods are up for sale, that they can be moved off the land, and the third world has become an exotic fruit basket growing cocoa and coffee and rest for exports.
So do you see laws like or organizations like the WTO, NAFTA, CAFTA as being key vehicles in taking away this food from the third world?
Well, they have played a big role, because if you look at these trade agreements, let's take the case of NAFTA. I mean, there is evidence now, with more than a decade behind it, that nearly 500 campesinos are displaced from land each day, according to the Mexican farmers' organizations, because it is not a level playing field. We are not playing fair. What we have is a system which is heavily balanced in favor of, you know, your big corporations in the Midwest, the Cargills and the rest, who can continue to get subsidies. We're not talking about the small farmers in the U.S. or specialty growers getting subsidies. We're talking about the big agribusiness who can then dump grains in third world countries such as in Mexico, at below the cost of production. So there's no way a campesina in Mexico can compete with your ADM or your Cargill, because they have no subsidies, which were done away with thanks to the World Bank diktats and the IMF suggestions to developing countries. So it is an unfair battle, and they're bound to lose, and then you find a country like Mexico becoming dependent on the United States for its food. And when U.S. decides that they're going to use their corn for biofuels, it's a double whammy for Mexico, because they're dependent on the United States and they don't have access. So the prices just increase and the poor go hungry.
The media does a very poor job in explaining when the United States goes to the WTO, they're doing so on behalf of specific corporations. And I assume it's the same way in other countries as well.
Well, you know, you really cannot compare the rest of the world to the United States. It is the superpower, right? I'll tell you from my experience in trade negotiations, a few countries from Africa will come together and they'll have one trade negotiator. On the other hand, United States will march in with its army of trade negotiators, and I have to say, given 2 days, 24-hour long negotiations, and you'll see this poor African negotiator beginning to kind of just dismantle and demolish in front of you. Whether it is your no-dos or whatever it is, they keep going. The texts are provided at the last minute. When all of it fails, of course, you know, you'll have a phone call to the Prime Minister's office that we saw in Qatar in the case of India, which was resisting the talks and saying that it was going to harm the livelihoods of farmers in their countries. They cannot agree to a trade agreement. There was a call from, to the Prime Minister's office saying you need to back off or your aid won't be given. We heard the same stories from Thailand in Cancun. But the fact that WTO, for instance, has been stuck, you know, it was 10 years ago in Seattle that it collapsed. And the only time it could move was in Qatar after 9/11, when United States' message to the world was, you're either with us or against us, and that applied to trade negotiations as well. It hasn't really moved anywhere again, and that's because the farmers, the civil society in third world countries, are holding the governments accountable. And unfortunately, the media does a really bad job in the United States, so the public does not know that they need to make their government accountable. We are doing that in our part of the world. We are holding our governments accountable. But the United States public has to rise up. The citizenry has to rise up and make change happen.
What positive examples have you seen in the third world resisting the United States' further takeover of food supplies?
Well, there's several. I mean, that's the beauty of it. We were earlier talking about genetically engineered crops. Countries like Zambia, I mean, it's an old example, 2002, but I think it's very significant. It was reeling from hunger. It was identified by the World Food Program as being food insecure. Appeals were made for food aid. And United States said, well, we're going to use Zambia in our battle with the EU around acceptance of GM crops. They wanted to send genetically engineered corn. Zambia refused. It was a little bit ridiculous. Tony Hall, U.S. representative to the FAO, threatened and said Zambia should be taken to the International Criminal Court. Somebody had to remind him that U.S. does not believe in the International Criminal Court. The newspapers in the U.S. were full of reports about Zambia, evil government, starving its own population. Not one of them would report that it was a process, a really democratic process where farmers' organizations, consumer groups, doctors, policymakers, they all had a national process, and they decided that it was not in the favor of Zambia that they should adopt and accept this GM food aid. They were asking for this corn to be milled so nobody could plant it, so the lands would not be polluted, and U.S. would not do that. So Zambia still succeeded. Nobody starved. They focused on their traditional crops such as cassava, which again are an important message that we think of food security by thinking of the crops from the West which have been sent to the third world. Nobody starved. More important, next year, Zambia had a bumper crop that World Food Program was buying from Zambia to provide to nations in sub-Saharan Africa. So that's one great example. And of course, Zambia is not alone. We know Zimbabwe, Mozambique have stood up and said no to GM food aid from the United States. And again, in terms of victory, the fact we do not have the World Trade Organization hasn't been able to move forward. The so-called Doha Development Round, there's nothing about development in that round, hasn't moved forward. Every time there has been a mini-ministerial, for instance, just this past year, countries have walked out. The last time was when Kamal Nath, then the Indian Commerce Minister, said, you know, it is really unfortunate that these talks are collapsing around the issue of livelihoods when this is supposed to be the development round. But the battle is not yet over. This November, actually the same dates as Seattle 10 years ago, WTO is holding its ministerial, this time in Geneva. And they're hoping to put a lot of pressure, move things forward. They have been influencing, for instance, they made sure there's a different person who's a commerce minister in India, who perhaps would be a little bit more flexible. But what they are forgetting is that just this September, 80,000 farmers marched in the streets of New Delhi. They went and filed a complaint to the police station against the parliamentarians who might sell their livelihoods. So it is not going to be enough to put the right guy as the Commerce Minister of India, because whoever's in place would have to be answerable to hundreds of thousands. And in fact, in my country, nearly 700 million people who are farmers. And that's where hope lies.
Final question. If you were put in charge of the decisions at the Gates Foundation for their World Hunger Program, what would you do?
That's a great question. What would I do? Several things that can be done. I mean, I think it's so wonderful to have this kind of resources. First of all, I would see the funding as really as a part of, let's see, how you would say it in English, like an industrial assembly line. Thank you. My English was failing me there. The whole assembly line from the farmers to going up to the policy environment. So, you know, it's great if we focus on farmers being able to use appropriate technologies and conservation agriculture and agroecology to boost production, and to not see agriculture really as a linear way of just increasing food production, but to see the multifunctionality of agriculture. It is about farmers being the stewards of the land, the ones who protect the biodiversity, which is the only way we'll save the planet, which is a great way of dealing with climate change, because nearly 30-40% of CO2 emissions come from agriculture, the way we do it, industrial agriculture. So to completely change the way we do it. But the problem is, if we invest on those small examples, you know, and provide that support, if we don't change the larger policy environment, one step forward is 10 steps back. So while we focus on those beautiful examples, because we know how to feed the world in ways which are sustainable and good for the environment and communities, we would also ensure that policy space is created in the way, for instance, third world governments have access to information, that money is being put in real research, that we are looking at not just GM crops, but looking at investing in, for instance, giving grants to a UC system, which is completely cash strapped and therefore gets into relationship with companies such as Novartis to focus their research on GM crops, that they are doing research on agroecology, on sustainable ways of feeding the world, to people having access to the policymakers. So there's a lot of things you can do, but you have to have a vision. But if your vision is one of displacing people from land, if your vision is that to do harm to people that you profess to benefit, none of that would happen. So I think even if you put me in that place, if the vision of the foundation is not changed, Anuradha Mittal wouldn't be able to do anything. So what really Gates Foundation needs is to basically close the doors, go down and be in Africa, be on the ground with the farmers, go spend time in the suicide belt of India, where more than 180,000 farmers have taken their own lives in the last 10 years. And those are government figures. Our figures would be higher. Speak to their families. Speak to the women farmers who have lost a brother, father, son, who's killed himself because they could not provide for their families and pay back the loans. And they will know the vision. Because those farmers will tell you of the times when they used cow dung as fertilizer. They didn't have to take loans from the bank to buy these fertilizers, chemical fertilizers. They'll tell you of the times when they were rural banks, when financial deregulation hadn't resulted in all the credit facilities in rural areas being closed down because they were seen as losers. So they'll tell you all that stuff. They'll tell you about the marketing boards, for instance, which ensured floor prices. Everyone talks about increasing production. Nobody talks about, you know, ensuring floor prices. Why would a farmer increase production if there's no floor price? Go speak to the dairy farmers in the U.S. They have to, you know, reduce production to get subsidies. So that's what I would do if I was really at the Gates Foundation. Ask them to go spend some time with the people who are doing agriculture.
How can people find out more about the Oakland Institute?
A great resource is a website where people can download any of the reports for free, and there's some amazing reports there, and the website is www.oaklandinstitute.org. That's one word, oaklandinstitute.org.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks so much.